Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Joining us on this week's show is the amazing artist Chaos. He talks about where he's been and where he's going, not to mention dropping some exclusive news just for you. We also speak with Diane Keith about dealing with your aging parents and how to help them transition to assisted living. Up next is John Frank talking about nutrient-dense food and if we're being provided with them by our grocery stores and local markets. We wrap things up with safety expert David Nance and a remix from Ollie Murs, Troublemaker.
Capture your need for sound.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show, the one and only rapper Chaos. Chaos, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
So I'm so happy to have you on the show. We're big fans of your work, and I wanted to talk to you, first of all, by just getting a sense, did you always know you were going to be an artist, or was this sort of, did it come to you as you went sort of through your teenage years?
I think I always, I mean, my mom used to say I used to, my parents are very religious, so my mom used to say that I would, when I was a kid, we came home from church, and it was something, you know, the lesson was about Jesus. I used to take a mop and put it on my head and pretend to be Jesus. So that's, if that doesn't tip off somebody that there's some kind of complex of, you know, feeling you're special. I think it's your child, everyone, your parents make you feel special all the time. And then you go to school and you see you're different. And I think music just allowed me to maintain that feeling, special feeling. So as a kid, it was just always this place I went to. And then, of course, you see people on TV making a living out of it. You're like, oh, this is where I go to feel good, and I can actually do it for a living. So I think it all started to piece together probably around when I was about 10 or 11. I started writing songs. I was living in Trinidad. My grandmother gave me a Yamaha, kind of like a organ you blow into. I forget what it's called now. She gave me a Billy Joel songbook. And she wanted me to learn Just the Way You Are by Billy Joel, which is a great song for, you know, let your grandkid learn. But I never thought about it. But and then from there, it was just, you know, continuous, liking Michael Jackson and all the 80s and just, you know, Kurt Cobain. I was born on the same day as him, so I followed that whole thing like I was him, kind of. So it was like the mixing of like this black culture music I had, and then Kurt Cobain, basically being born on the same day as him, I identified with his struggle of like trying to be an artist, but money, but, you know, being a Pisces, being kind of weird, but just normal too. So I think around teenage years, Nirvana was like the arriving of like, I want to do this. Maybe not the way he did it, but it made me see that I could do it. Just a regular person from a small town could do it.
Did you plan to meld all these different styles together? Because you have the rap, but you also have the rock going on, which we're going to talk about when we talk about your latest album, Black on Blonde. But was it a conscious decision to meld these things together?
Okay, so I kind of veered there. Well, yes, but staying true to your question of, did I know I was going to be an artist? Because I never answered the question. Yes, and I think I knew it because I loved all music, and I felt like as a Canadian, that was allowed. And I feel like that was always sort of my thing, where I was like, I'm going to do all these things because I loved it all. And I thought it was such a huge, like if someone gave you a bunch of paints and there was like six or seven and someone gave you like a box of like 25, you know, I think you'd dive into the 20. No, some people might pick the smaller amount, but I feel like that's what this country makes it so amazing, is a melting pot of so many different styles. That used to happen when I'd be like, go home, and my mom would be cooking a Trinidadian meal, but as soon as I went to the school ground, it was all about like the new trends and fitting in. So that dichotomy definitely informed my music, and it informed me to what kind of artist I think I'm growing into.
Do you prefer being on stage or in the studio?
Studio's mad pressure because you got to come up with material that's bankable, as they say. You know, anyone could go in the studio, but for me, it's always like, oh, Sunday morning, okay, Crab Bucket, okay, Natalie Portman, now it's Dog Is Mine. It's like the stakes just keep going up with what you have to do better than. So there's a little stress there, but the moment of achieving a song like that is like, it's the closest thing to someone winning a Super Bowl in the studio. Everyone's like, yes, we did it. So it's a great feeling. Live is tough because it doesn't depend on you. There's a sound. You have guys you're touring with. If they're in a bad mood, your tour manager might not tell you the right thing. So the road is a little more iffy. But, you know, when you get it right and you do a great show, same feeling, Super Bowl, like you won it. And you get to experience that, for me, more with a group of guys than just myself in the studio with a couple engineers or something. So they both have their pressures, but I would say the road is a little bit more real to how music started, and you see the personalities and you see sort of problems, and the greatness comes from how people first started doing music, which is just being nomads in a tribe traveling around. So it's a cool thing.
I heard somewhere that Prince said that when he writes a song, he always tries to write a hit. How do you view yourself? I know you said there's pressure in the studio, but how do you go about when you attack a song?
It's usually the girl I'm dating. So it's very planned, but I don't know it's planned till after. So I'll see a girl, like, totally be floored by her, but it's more of her, like, musical tastes. That's what really gets me, or her style that comes out. And then when I see her and then we start hanging out, I realize that it's about her style. And she starts opening me to all these things. And then I'm on this pursuit to make this song to make her go, wow. You know, because I think at first I usually will pick somebody who would not even be a fan of me. Like, a lot of times I end up hanging out with girls, they're like, oh, I don't really like your music. And they're really serious, though. They're like, you're cool, but your music's not good, you know? And so I try to win them over by, like, bending what I've done already to. So that's something new that I'm finding out, as been accused by my last one. She put it in my face and I denied it, but now we no longer talk and I'm heartbroken. I realize she is correct. I was a little bit of calculated, but you know, we all do things for survival. And sometimes as a musician, if someone doesn't call you on it and you're getting away with it, it just works for you. So I'm all about it if it's the truth. I love her for that she told me that, but it usually begins with, you know, a woman. Anything that I've learned about music or been shown that was new and cool is not from another guy. It's always a girl. It's like, you've never heard this? And they put you onto it, you know? So I'd say that's the hit. The real hit is having someone that you may be skeptical of you be kind of won over by the music. And it's sort of romantic, too, so it's a good gauge for me.
Is there an instrument that personifies you, Chaos, like that you really identify with, that speaks you?
Probably the turntable. And that's because when I became, I Wikipedia'd myself, and they said piano, keyboards, guitar, and turntable. I was like, oh, that's the truest one. Because when you're a DJ, you're an observer of the music. You're just like, this is, you might play something for 5 seconds and then just be like, I'm not going to play this at a party. And then you hear something in the first note, you're like, damn, I can't wait to play this. And you start getting in your vibe of selecting songs to play. And I'm like, that's how I feel about how I make records. I'm like, oh, a rock song. Oh, this reggae song fits good. This Police acapella fits really well over this, like, whatever, whatever. And I start doing that musically. Like, a lot of my songs are, the music is rock and roll, but like with a R&B or like soul vocal or something, where it's like you're mashing things up. So I would say the turntable probably is the instrument. Although a lot of people don't consider it to be, from a hip hop standpoint, it is the instrument that started hip hop. So I pay homage to the turntable for sure.
Now, your album Black on Blonde, I'm sure you've answered this question a million times. Like, you know, what does it mean to you? And you have it's a double album, basically. But how would you explain to your fans, like, what do you want them to take away from it? Like, is there one word or one vibe that you want them to take away from Black on Blonde?
I think Black on Blonde is, you know, I talk about race a lot. I have always. And my mom was like, don't talk about it so much. You're always talking about it. And I've tried not to talk about it. But I, as a kid that grew up in an all-white school, and the only black guy, it's just in my face. I always would see how different I looked. My hair was different. The food I would bring to school, what's that? And it's like, you were always sort of different. And so for me to just try, you know, be fake and say, oh, I don't care about it anymore, it's a lie, because I'm sort of obsessed with what race makes people do. Like, you could be a complete outside of black culture, but if you make black music, people think it's funny. It all of a sudden becomes ironic and funny. And you could be like, you know, a bunch of black guys, and if you chose to do metal, the picture itself would be a joke. But why? Is it because music by nature is racist at its core, because it's about people of a certain culture getting together to enjoy the sound of their culture? So that was the first issue that came up. And then there was the whole, like, you know, Drake and the whole, like, half Jewish, half white, and became part of his story. And I was like, oh, that's not fair that he gets to, you know, he's a rapper, but that becomes a part of his story. I'm going to do something that's half black and half white and keep it about the music. And so it was all, and I'm realizing that now. 2 days ago, I said to we were talking about Drake or something, and I was like, yeah, that did affect me. It was almost like being half black and half white was more acceptable, or people were making a big deal about it when it's Canada. And it made me, as a person who's definitely black and parents are black and grandparents are black, feel like, how is this going to affect me? So it was my kind of cultural statement on, oh, wait a second, one of Drake's parents had to be black, one of them had to be white. So why don't I just make a record that is at the core of the whole existence of the whole thing? I don't think people get that, and I haven't said that on any other radio station. You being a very gracious host, I'm giving you secret X-Files spread across. And, you know, it's not like my record's about Drake. It's like Blonde on Blonde is Bob Dylan's my favorite. So the core of it is Bob Dylan-esque, a guy that goes electric, was conscious, or a folk singer, as people saw me in the beginning of my career. I relate to Dylan because he really got caught up in this whole, you know, speaker of a movement, and people saw me like that. I think heaven only knows in the early years they were like, yo, this guy's a protest rapper and he hates mainstream hip hop. So, you know, Black on Blonde is forever gonna, for me, the record that's like, this is one side of me and this is the other side of me. And what you're witnessing is I rapped over guitars in my early career, not because I wanted to be a protest rapper, because I like rock and roll. But it just came off as that because instead you add guitar to hip-hop, especially in the early 90s or late 90s, it's like it automatically is a revolution because everyone was using keyboards, and it was Puff Daddy, and, you know, it was all about fat cars in your video. So a dude in a white t-shirt rapping over acoustic hip-hop, all of it was just by default conscious. So it's Bob Dylan is the core, and then the idea that, you know, black people can be versatile. And just because we dress a certain way, we look a certain way, doesn't mean... I mean, I will end it by going, it's okay, picket fences were dope, Martin Luther King and, you know, the movement. But I think if you can resend someone's culture back to them intact and they like it. I had a friend of mine from Calgary said, yo, my friend, he's just a straight white dude. He's a fisherman. He's like, yo, that Chaos song, dog, is mine. Great rock track, man. I was like, why is that a big deal? He's like, because this dude is white. Like, when he told, I didn't even know it was him. Like, it's like that kind of idea where you present someone's culture back to them and they don't even think about your race or culture. Same thing with Eminem. When I heard, I'm like, oh, this guy's retarded. It's ridiculous. And I think that does more for racial relations and culture than, you know, saying I like everybody. Well, if you really like me, let me hear you sing some Otis Redding. Because if you really like me, I won't be able to tell that it's not Otis Redding. And hopefully the world gets to that point in 100 years, 200 years, where you don't look at someone and think the sound coming out of their mouth has to be Southern or Nova Scotian or Quebecois. It's just, it is what it is. And I think, if anything, I would say in this interview, for the future, if you're listening to this 100 years from now, I hope you go, someone checks my music and know that I was about that from the instant I got a record deal. And whatever said about me, I hope people know that at the end, it was all about trying to bring man to that point where you looked at someone, you couldn't tell what kind of record they were going to make. Because hopefully the next record, people like, they pick it up and they don't know what I'm going to do. There's no way they can know because I just don't fall into any category. And I think that freedom is unbelievable. I'm so happy. I'm happy. I walk around just smiling because of that, because I'm a musician that's been able, because of this country and how great it is and multicultural, to do a music where there's no genre. And that to me is just, you know, I'm emotional about that. I couldn't ask for a better job.
Now, before I let you go, last question. Obviously, you're promoting the album Black on Blonde now. What can we expect from you in the next, like, year to, you know, 2 years? Like, are you going to do more music? Are you going to take a break for a bit? TV, movies, what?
More exclusives on her show. I'm actually working on a jazz record, a jazz hip-hop record, because I think I'm like Trap Called Quest, Diggable Planets, I'm all on that with the CBC. It's not in stone right now, but I saw a jazz band play in Vancouver, and I bugged, and I approached them, and I said, do you guys want to do like 4 or 5 songs? So we're in the works of figuring out how we're going to do this. Very Diggable Planets, back to upright bass, that era of hip-hop. That's what I'm on next.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the Kelly Alexander Show.
You're awesome, Kelly. Thank you for having me.
Got to pack my things and go. Move fast, not slow. Dog is mine. Oh, you've got to pack your things and go. Move fast, not slow. That dog is mine. You know that you gotta go. So go. I thought you don't have a soul. The sun is setting well. We've got to let it go. We were too deaf for wedding bells and too naive to know. Got to pack my things and go. Move fast, not slow. The dog is mine. mine. Go ahead, the hand that you better sell. We'll fall in love with somebody else. Sometimes it's better to live in sin than in love when you don't want someone to win.
So now the sun is setting well.
And go, move fast, not slow. The dog is mine.
Oh, you
got to pack your things and go. Move fast, not slow. That dog is mine.
Malibu, Prius drive. Who took who for a ride? Wild fox, black boots, more shots. Half truths, easy come, easy go. Yoga mat, Yoda flow. Canyon road, Hayden's house. Turn me up, fade me out. Spare keys, insert argument, ecstasy. Don't stand so next to me. Computer screens, swallow us. Look at all my followers. Everybody get down, I'm taking over. Got to pack my things and go. Move fast, not slow. The dog is mine.
Oh, you
got to pack your things and go. Move fast, not slow. That dog is mine. Is mine. Move fast, not slow. The dog is mine. Move fast, not slow. That dog is mine.
As our population continues to age, many more of us will at some point in our lives have to deal with one or more aging parent or family members. Caring for a loved one can be stressful, but it also can be exhausting and time-consuming. Joining us today is Diane Keefe, a professional geriatric care manager. Diane has dealt with her own personal situations, as well as many other difficult situations dealing with older adults throughout her life. Today, she's going to be discussing some of the difficulties around dealing with aging parents, how to cope, and how to transition aging parents into a nursing home. Diane, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thanks for having me, Kelly.
Diane, how important is it for aging parents to get out every day to be, you know, sort of moving around and also to socialize with other people?
Well, it's paramount to keeping their mobility. You know, one of the things that can really stop them in their tracks is not being able to get out and socialize. So it's very important, not only for their heart health and for their brain health, but for their social well-being.
At what point should you start talking to your parents about the possibility of getting care outside of what you're already giving them?
Well, when they get to the point where they're not really thriving, where they're not staying engaged in life, or where they're having a little bit of difficulty, that's the time to start considering maybe having an in-home aide in or a companion, even just for a few hours a week.
What about when it comes to legal documents? When should children be asking or pushing their family members to have, you know, certain legal documents prepared? Because I know we've been through this with my own family, and I know it can be a touchy subject.
Well, it may be touchy, but I'm not exactly sure how it works in Canada. I know that in the U.S., you have to have healthcare power of attorney to be able to advocate for someone. And you need an advance directive that spells out what kind of medical treatment you want at end of life when there's no possibility of recovery.
Okay. That's very interesting.
So some people will opt not to have a feeding tube or not to have extreme means to prolong their life, because if they're already on their way out, what's the point?
Right. Right. Okay. And I know we talked about it sort of being a difficult conversation to have, but
you know, these legal documents need to be taken care of sort of, you know, it's better before than when you're in the thick of things.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, I recommend them that they're taken care of immediately. In fact, one of the reasons why I wrote my book was because I went through it with my mother. She had Alzheimer's, and we were not prepared for this whole experience. We didn't know what to expect. Part of the time, she wasn't wanting to cooperate with what we were thinking she needed. And we really didn't know how to be proactive with her. So, you know, as I went into getting an education in gerontology and forming my own geriatric care management practice, I realized that, you know, and I was running into caregivers that said, gee, we just need something that tells us what to do because you really don't know what you're doing until it's over.
Okay, okay.
And so that's why I put together a book called Blueprint for Care, which is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And then I did a companion book that takes caregivers, family caregivers, through everything they need to know to end of life.
Which is very
important. Because you really can't anticipate it until you've been through it.
Now, when it actually comes to your family member needing more care, what's the best way to approach bringing up the subject with your loved one? Because, again, touchy subject.
Yes. Well, you know, approach it from the standpoint that you're concerned, that you really want the best for them, that you want them to have a quality of life, and how can you support them? That would be the best approach. Now, sometimes you might need to elicit the help of a physician or a family attorney to help in nudging the parent along. But, you know, that's only if you can't reach them from a heart-to-heart conversation.
Do you suggest getting this done by a certain age, or is it basically a case-by-case? Because, you know, some 80-year-olds look better than 60-year-olds.
You're right, and aging is not equal. I would suggest that, you know, any time after 50, you start sitting down and having a conversation with your parent about, you know, what things they've got in place and who they would like to speak for them if they're not able to speak for themselves.
Okay, perfect. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is geriatric care manager Diane Keefe. For more tips and information, make sure to check out her website, caringforparentstogether.com. When you're looking for a suitable nursing home, Diane, what should you be looking for?
Well, there are a number of things. You may want to go through JAYCO, it's G-A-Y-C-O, who provides the quality standards and the inspections of different hospital organizations. In Canada, they may have something very similar, and I know I've got a friend there that is involved in that aspect. So you'll want to make sure that the hospital has, or the medical facility has been approved medically. And then when you're going into a nursing home, does it smell good? Does it feel homey? Ask your loved one what it is that they need before you even start looking. And then decide on the location of where friends would be apt to visit. Because that's very important. They don't want to be feeling like they're being imprisoned in some place. They want to feel like they're going to be at home. And it's just a continuation of their life.
In your experience, Diane, when the family is sort of looking into this, I guess, and again, it depends, I know, on how the specific person is, like physically and mentally and all that sort of stuff, but can it be somewhat of a two-step process, meaning they might go into this particular care facility for now, but if they continue to live, they might eventually have to go to another facility?
Absolutely, Kelly. And what you may want to look for is something called a continuum of care. That means that if they go in and then they have a health event that makes it so that they need more care, they can move within the same facility.
Okay.
That's important because you don't want to be moving someone when they're in the midst of a health event.
Right.
You know, they're usually groggy from anesthesia and medications, and they're really not able to adapt as well.
And I find, just in my own experience with my grandparents, and again, they were all sort of different characters. Some of them are more willing to change or to deal or adapt with change than others. And so obviously that's something that most people go through, where they might have one grandparent or one parent who is okay with sort of, you know, realizing that this is the way life is, and then other ones really, you know, put their heels down.
Yes, it's true. And a lot of it has to do with their early experiences with, you know, death and dying and what they experienced with their relatives. So if they had a poor experience, they're not likely to, you know, want to repeat that for themselves.
Right. So it's almost like their history can determine how well they're handling this whole situation.
Yes, part of it, and their ability to change and deal with change. Everyone's different, as you said, and you just have to work with them on their terms.
And I'm assuming that it's really important that you try to remain as patient as possible, because again, like I know, for example, in my mother's case with my grandfather, she really had to be extremely patient with just getting him there, you know, like because it was like he fought so hard about getting into this facility, and she sort of had to really, like, it was amazing that my mom is as patient as she is, but she really had to knuckle down because he really did sort of put up a trying experience.
Yes, and I went through that with my mother as well. We got to a point where it wasn't safe for her to be at home alone by herself any longer. And we went through the exploration of finding a facility that was in an area where everyone traveled so she would have visitors. She was still furious with us for the first month. But afterwards, she said, "This is the best thing I had ever done."
Oh, great.
It was exactly what I needed to do at this point. And from that point, she never looked back. She said, "I'm so glad that you did this for me."
That's amazing. And that's, I think, what you as a family need to keep your eye on the prize, because I know that certain individuals, not that they mean to, but they can be very manipulative as well and make you sort of feel very guilty for taking this step.
Absolutely. Okay. And others will just thrive.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you as well, we talked about, you know, what sort of things to be on the lookout for when you are going towards a care facility. What things would you avoid, Diane?
Well, just because a facility is beautiful does not mean that the service is real good. So what you really need to look at is, what is the response time from the time that someone hits a call button until someone actually responds to it, and find out what that response is both during the day and at night. What is the ratio of aides to patients during the day and at night? And most facilities will allow you to come and check out the food. So look for that as well. If you're going into a facility that is assisted living, see what the ratio of men to women is. You don't want to put a man in a facility that has nothing but women. He'll probably be very uncomfortable.
Right.
So those are some of the things that you might look for.
And
if someone has been in a blue-collar community all their lives, they're not going to feel comfortable going into a facility that's highly decorated.
Right. So you really need to be aware of where they've come from.
Yes.
Okay. And when it comes to, you know, going down this path and making the transition, what would be your top tip or tips, again, for families that need to go through this? Because, again, it is such a trying experience, and I only know that because of watching my mother go through this.
Yes. Well, start talking about it early. Find different ways that you can meet their needs. You know, initially you might have someone come into their home and just have a companion. But if it gets to the point where they're needing a lot more care and you can't handle it, approach it from the standpoint of how it's really stressing you, that you really want the best care for them, and, you know, that it would give you peace of mind if they would go into a facility where they have a higher level of care and protection.
Diane, can you give out the name of your book again and where people can find it?
Sure. It's called Blueprint for Care. You can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And you can also get it on my website, which is caringforparentstogether.com.
Fantastic.
And then, Kelly, I'd like your listeners to know that I have a talk show as well that's geared towards caregiving.
Okay.
And it's called Caring for Parents Together on Blog Talk Radio.
Fantastic. And they can access that online, I assume, as well?
They can, and they can find it on my website as well.
Perfect. Diane, thank you so much for your time today. We really, really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
That was geriatric care manager Diane Keefe. Again, for more information and resources, check out her website, as she mentioned, caringforparentstogether.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Healthy eating isn't always an easy thing to do, nor is it always affordable. But do we really know what we're buying when we go shopping for fresh produce at the grocery store? John C. Frank is co-owner of International AG Labs. He is active in all aspects of producing and promoting nutrient-dense foods. He's joining us today to discuss how we are being defrauded at the grocery store and how organic and locally grown doesn't always mean it's the healthiest choice. John, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly.
What does it mean to have a nutrient-dense food?
Well, there's been several attempts to define nutrient-dense foods, and certain groups have looked at liver versus lettuce and said, okay, liver is nutrient-dense and lettuce is not. And I never really found that to be the right kind of a definition. Another way of looking at it is to look at the amount of nutrients divided by the amount of carbohydrates or calories. And so when you do that, then greens come up on top as being nutrient-dense. The problem with that is that these greens can be good, high quality, that are raised well in soil, or they could be quite poor in quality. They're still considered greens and nutrient-dense. So I didn't really find that definition really workable. So then I've thought about it, and I came up with the conclusion what we're really talking about is more nutrients per bite. What we really want to see is the foods reach their genetic, close to their genetic potential. So we're comparing that food against its genetic potential.
Are we getting nutrient-dense food in our local grocery stores, John?
Not very much. Occasionally there will be a rare find that is really good quality, and you'll notice it by its flavor. But for the most part, we are getting average or poor, and mostly poor, quality food. And so, you know, D-minus grade on our food for what the amount of minerals and nutrients that it should contain.
In your opinion, what are the most nutrient-dense foods that we can actually find right now?
That's kind of going back to the first question of what's got more in it when you're comparing one food against the other.
Okay.
And really what we want to do is compare one food against itself. So an orange, we don't want to compare with a banana. We want to compare oranges with oranges and say, here's what a good orange is. Overall, of course, the fruits and the vegetables are going to give a lot of the living enzymes and antioxidants, and that's good. But a lot of those are so nourishing that we're not getting what we think we're getting, even though we're eating the right foods.
And, you know, the big thing I would say the last couple of years for sure is, you know, organic, organic, organic. So about organic foods, do they actually have more nutrients or do they not?
You know, there was a large study released, I believe it was by Cornell, that was a meta study, and they were looking at organic food. And their conclusion was organic food is not more nutrient rich than regular foods. And a lot of the organic people let out a big hue and cry over this because I thought it was more of a slam job. My experience as a laboratory owner and looking at food quality is that probably is correct. Some of the organics can be at the very top and the very highest quality, and other foods that are organic could be at the very bottom. And generally, it follows the same trend as our foods in general, which is way underperforming what it should. So it's kind of a mixed bag on that.
How about locally grown foods that can be bought at a market? Do they have any, you know, significant benefits to them or not?
Well, I think there's benefits to both organic and to local. You're supporting your local community, and that's good. And the organics have their heart generally in the right place, unless it's the big commercial organics. And so I'm not trying to put down on either of them. I want to make that real clear. Just because they're organic or local, it does not mean the food quality is up. Yes, you avoid shipping if it's local, and that can be of some gain, but it's not the big thing that we're looking for. We're actually looking for more minerals put into the food, and that goes back entirely according to the way the plants were raised and the stewardship that was given to that soil.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is co-owner of International AG Labs, John C. Frank. For more information, you can go to aglabs.com or check out johnsfreereport.com. John, what kinds of things should we as consumers be on the lookout for? Because in the end, it does come down to us being proactive, I would think.
Well, there's some certain things that you can look at in the grocery store that can be a very good help. The number one thing is when you buy produce, look for the taste. If it's tasting really good, that's a good indicator that it's better quality. The other thing is you can look for weight. So if you compare some things of equal sizes, get a feel for the weight, and things that are heavier are going to be better quality. There's a lot of little tips that you can do to try to select better quality. For example, with bananas, if you'll go for the smaller bananas, they'll have a little bit more nutrients in it than the big bananas. Citrus, you want to have a smooth, thin skin. The thinner that skin, the better. A real thick skin is an indicator of a lower quality citrus. Grapes, if you cut them in half, should be more to the pearly white side in its ideal than the translucent on the inside. And sometimes you'll see layers that's kind of pearlish, off-white, and then inside in the center might be translucent. That just indicates that it got better calcium as it was growing more toward the end of its growing season. There's a number of tips like that, but ultimately I'm suggesting that people consider small backyard gardens where, even if it's very small, just to help augment what they're buying.
Are there things that we should be avoiding altogether, John?
I suggest avoiding the genetically modified foods. Right now, sweet corn that's commercially grown sweet corn could be genetically modified. Most of the other produce is not. There's a little here and there. I suggest not consuming GMO foods just as a precaution, and nature seems to be bearing witness to that. I can tell you a story on that if you're interested.
Sure, go ahead.
We had a customer that bought some GMO corn, just some whole shell corn, and he was going to put it up on his bird feeder. And he stuck it in a bag in the garage, didn't cover it or seal it or anything. And he has some non-GMO conventional grown corn. This would be hybrids, but not GMO. And he had some of that as well in his corn in a bag in the garage, and he left them both over winter. He had forgotten about all of it. And come springtime, the bag with the non-GMO corn was completely eaten up. Every kernel was gone off the cob, and the bag with the GMO, there was not one kernel eaten, and the mice had access equally to both.
Wow. What do you take away from that in the grand scheme, John?
And mice are not... they're not scientifically biased, and they don't read the scientific papers, so they're just going to go by their instinct of nature. And I think we've seen a number of other stories like that.
And John, where do you want to see things heading in the next couple of years when it comes to this? Like, what do you want from our side as a consumer, and you know, on the other side as well?
I'm looking for food to be bought and sold on the basis of quality or nutrient density. That would be one of the things that, if the consumer is willing to buy quality and pay for it at a little better pricing, instead of buying on the basis of least cost, they're going to save a lot in terms of their health. The getting food that's just undersupplied in trace minerals is a long-term damage to people's health, whether it's not supporting the immune system or not supporting the sugar balancing aspects of the body. We're seeing a lot of medical problems. And I believe fundamentally they come from a food supply that's not raised very healthy. And so buying on the basis of quality is probably the biggest thing. And then there is one other tool that can be used to determine produce quality. It involves a purchase, but it's a very good tool as well to check for produce quality. The tool is called a refractometer, and you squeeze the juice out of the produce. So whether it's a tomato and you put a few drops of that juice on, and it gives a reading called a Brix reading. And then you have a chart where it's poor, average, good, or excellent, and you compare on that produce where it's at. So it's kind of like a mechanical taste tester, and it's going to give you the quality, kind of an empirical number where a taste is rather subjective.
And, John, what would be your final tip or piece of advice that you really want to leave, you know, my listeners with, so that it's sort of at the forefront of their thoughts when it comes to this stuff?
Well, I would say start with that free report. It gives a lot of detailed laying out of some of the things, what's happened to our food supply and why it's important to be concerned about it. But consider growing a very small garden, even if it's on a patio or something, just to begin to grow some food of your own.
Fantastic. I think that's a great piece of advice, John. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kelly.
That was John C. Frank, again, co-owner of International AG Labs. For more information, again, check out aglabs.com or johnsfreereport.com.
Capture your need for sound.
It can be very easy to get into the routine of things and go about your day without being aware of what's going on around you. Now, not that you should be looking for a mugger under every bush or around every corner, but it's very important to be aware of your everyday surroundings so you keep yourself safe. To help guide us as to what we should be aware of and how to protect ourselves from harm is nationally acclaimed safety expert David Nance. He developed the Sabre Law Enforcement Training Division, which works with thousands of police departments worldwide. David, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. How are you today?
I am great. Thank you, David. And I have to ask you, I guess, start off by asking you, you know, I don't want to instill fear in our listeners, but I think that a lot of us get caught up in our daily routines and we don't pay as much attention to our surroundings and what's going on.
Well, you're exactly right. We make ourselves soft targets. A soft target is someone that's walking around distracted, and people are very distracted in 2011 by technology, and that's only becoming more and more the case. Walking, you know, across the street texting or talking on their cell phone, caught up in the course of the conversation and not aware of what's taking place around them. So it's predators, attackers, muggers, they look for people who are not paying attention, who are soft targets, who are easy targets so they can take advantage of them quickly, accomplish their goal with the least amount of effort, least chance that they'll be caught when they're doing this. So you're exactly right. What we want to do is teach people to be prepared but not scared.
I think one of the statistics for driving is that, you know, you mostly get into an accident not far from home. So I'm wondering if, with regards to this, is it that you sometimes can actually, you know, get attacked or whatever not far from home? Because I almost feel like we feel inherently safe in our neighborhood, even though there can be threats.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You're very vulnerable when walking to and from your car, and not only because you're in the public eye when that takes place, but the attacker also knows that you're thinking about something else. You're thinking about either what you're going to do once you go inside your house or where you're going to go once you get inside your car. So you're preoccupied with these tasks. You're not thinking about what's taking place around you. You make yourself a soft target and an easier victim.
And what's the most important, you know, thing that women especially, I guess, should be aware of?
Well, I think that you want to. What one of the things we teach in my course is we have the Sabre Personal Safety Academy is we teach our students to visualize these things in advance. Assume that this situation will happen to you. And when you're in that situation, you've already played it out in your head exactly what you're going to do, what you're going to say, how you're going to keep distance, the eye contact that you're going to make, how you will discourage that threat before that attack occurs. So in hopes that the attack actually does not occur, there are some things that you can do to discourage that threat. Let them know that you're much of a challenge for them and they should take their time and effort elsewhere. But you absolutely are vulnerable when walking to and from your car and visualizing these things in advance. But being prepared to act is the most important thing you can do.
And do some women just come off as easy targets? Because I feel like, you know, I guess sometimes we just feel like nothing's going to happen to us sometimes it just feels like we don't look confident as we're going around walking around.
Confidence is huge. You just hit the nail on the head exactly with that statement. They're looking for someone who lacks confidence, someone that looks timid. I mean, you know, attackers, in a sense, some say they're cowards. I mean, they want the easiest route possible to complete their goal. And when and finding someone that's timid, that doesn't look confident, not paying attention to their surroundings is definitely an easy situation, which is why we call them a soft target or an easy target.
And how, I guess, do you become then a hard target, David?
Well, one of the things we teach in our class, one of the easy way to remember this is to walk like a supermodel does. If you think how a supermodel walks, they walk with their shoulders back, their chin up. We tell them to add the additional step of scanning the area, walking with confidence and being ready to move, anticipating. Yeah, the other thing you can do aside from that, your body language is to also try to keep strangers at a safe distance. That's the number one thing. So you have time to act, to react, because their action is always going to be faster than your reaction. So the more distance you have between yourself and that individual, the safer you're going to be. And they also have the added advantages. They know when that attack is going to occur. You don't. So that's a big, big disadvantage. They know when the things will take place. You don't. So you have to assume when you're in these vulnerable situations by yourself, most often when it's, you know, dark outside, even though these things do happen in the daytime, you want to keep anyone that you don't know or not aware of at least 4 meters from you or 12 feet. Keep them at a distance. You have time to react. You have time to get to a safe place if necessary.
Joining us on the show right now is nationally acclaimed safety expert David Nance. Make sure to check him out. His website is www.personalsafetyexpert.com. David, I wanted to ask you as well, what tools should a woman have with her at all times? And also, I guess, does pepper spray come into that equation?
It certainly does. I'm a big advocate of pepper sprays or personal safety sprays. I mean, they allow you to protect yourself at a safe distance against multiple attackers. I mean, even the smallest keychain sprays have a distance of 3 meters or up to 10 feet. In Canada, for example, though, I know that pepper spray cannot be carried, but dog attack deterrent sprays can be carried. So, you know, people will carry them to protect themselves against stray dogs or to protect their dog against other attacking dogs. But if you have that product with you and you're in a situation where someone is going to attack you, I mean, essentially in that situation where, you know, you feel your safety or your life is in danger, you're able to use just about whatever means you have available to protect yourself. So if you are to acquire a dog attack deterrent spray, it's not a bad idea to keep that in hand when you're in a situation where you feel vulnerable. And, you know, and I also want to expand upon that. I mean, people talk about safe neighborhoods or they talk about safe scenarios. A predator can enter a safe neighborhood, and that area automatically becomes unsafe. So don't let your guard down just because you're in a wealthier area or an area where that is low crime. That can change in a second.
And something I think as well that I think maybe women forget, especially because I think as we're brought up, we're taught to be sort of nice and demure. I think it's really important to have a very loud, confident voice if you do have to scream at someone.
100%. That absolutely. And you will intimidate a person, a stranger, a man, whomever the person is when you do that. You'll catch them off guard and they'll become the soft target in that situation. It's amazing what a stern look, a mean look, and a loud verbal command like stop, get away, yelling that with authority will do to. That's something that will definitely help discourage a threat. In some situations, that may be enough, but you need to follow up and be prepared to move quickly and get out of that situation should the attack ensue.
And something else that I think a lot of women don't necessarily think about is when they're going out to socialize. I think a lot of people just feel, oh, I'm going to a bar or club. There's lots of people there. There must be techniques as well, David, that women should be aware of when they are going out to socialize.
Yeah, certainly. And you know, aside from using that technique that I just mentioned when you're, you know, going to and from your house or these parking lots or whatnot, you know, you also it's best also to travel in pairs. And when you're going out, ideally with your girlfriends or whatnot, you guys are going to stick together. And backing up to something you said previously with the verbal commands, we teach people it's okay to be rude. I mean, it's you're far more likely to discourage a potential threat by being rude than to turn someone, a decent human being, into an attacker because you're rude. So your safety is more important than what someone thinks about you. If you're in a situation where someone's pushing their limits or you feel uncomfortable, your sixth sense is kicking in saying something doesn't feel right, that's because it probably isn't and you should do something about that. And if the person crosses the line, you should be rude and just excuse yourself from that situation. And hopefully your friends are paying close attention to you as well. Maybe you have a code word or something where they can step in to get you out of that situation. And then there's the whole other issue of safe drinking. that comes into play when you're out socializing as well.
Which obviously means, I guess, obviously not drinking too much. And then I guess being aware of people putting stuff in your drink.
That's exactly it. Yeah, I mean, and one of the safest things you can do is drink out of a bottle, not out of an open cup or a glass. Never set it down. If you are going to accept a drink from a stranger, which I think is highly dangerous, you certainly want to walk with that individual to the bar, watch the bartender pour the drink, and watch it all the way into your hand to make sure it's not being tampered with.
David, a lot of young women are now away at, you know, college or university and perhaps, you know, away from home for the first time. What do you tell these young ladies who, you know, may be a bit naive to their new surroundings?
Well, and it's a challenging situation. It's an exciting situation for them. So many things are being thrown at them, and it's the first time in their lives where they're truly on their own, tasked with taking responsibility for their own personal safety. So we just tell them to enjoy themselves, but, you know, realize that there are tons of strangers that come onto university campuses that don't go to school there, whether it's, you know, staff members or it's people that work at the university that are not professors. It's people that visit these universities. So, you know, you gotta keep your guard up. And you're just because you're inside your residential housing, your apartment or your dorm, it doesn't mean you're safe either. There's all sorts of distraction techniques that people use to, you know, try to take advantage of college students, stuff that they've, you know, generally by nature they think people are good and they think that this situation isn't going to be a negative one. So we want to let these students know that these things are taking place. We give them statistics, we give them things to focus on. Because these, you know, the sad reality is in North America last year, there were over 10,000 students that were victimized. You're four times more likely to be sexually assaulted than any other age group college students are, and one in five college women are sexually assaulted. So the statistics are quite alarming. So it's something that the college community needs to be aware of.
And it must be important for, you know, a young lady to not be afraid to call campus security if they are leaving the library late or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, your resident director, your resident assistant, friends. I mean, yeah, you have these numbers on speed dial, and you should. It's far better to take an extra 10 minutes to wait for someone to come and help you out and get you safely across campus than it is to take that chance and walk by yourself in those vulnerable situations.
We've been focusing a lot on women, but I'm assuming that men should not take things for granted either. Like, they could still be mugged as they're walking down the street at night.
Absolutely. You certainly can. That situation happened to me. I was actually in Paris right out of college, and I actually had a conversation with the individual that mugged me. So quite embarrassing. But this stuff does happen. I mean, you know, they use distraction techniques. That's exactly what I just referred to. And, you know, men are certainly vulnerable, and especially now with you know, these flash mobs. I mean, men are being attacked more so than women in those situations, and they're taking their expensive belongings, whether it be their watch, their iPhone, iPad, things of that nature. So you definitely want to keep your guard up. You definitely want to be aware of your surroundings. You want to take those expensive gadgets, and you want to hide them when you're commuting to and from campus or to and from work.
Do you suggest, David, that men and women take, you know, defense classes or martial arts of some sort?
You know, I'm not against it. I think if you have the time and the money to allocate towards that, I think it's a great way to stay in shape. It's great for your brain. I think you can learn some things from it. I do want to say, though, the only disadvantage of that is that, you know, you could encounter someone that's, you know, faster, more skilled, or stronger than you are. And then, you know, that's why it's good to, if you are going to use that, don't assume that you're invulnerable. You still want to keep your best weapon is really your brain. You want to keep your mind sharp. You want to play this stuff out in your mind, know exactly what you're going to do if the situation does occur to you, so you don't freeze, so you don't get overcome by panic. So you're actually, you use the fear that you do have to energize you, to use your voice, to escape that attacker and get to a safe place.
And Dave, before I let you go, I guess a final question would be, if you were just talking right now to a group of women, what would be your key, you know, piece of advice to them as they go about their daily lives and daily routines?
I would say definitely anticipate this happening to you and your loved ones. So when you're in that situation, should it ever happen, you know exactly how to respond. That's number one. Number two would be to make yourself a hard target. Walk with confidence. Think about that supermodel thing that I mentioned before, walking like one of them with your head up, your shoulders back, scanning the area. And then take that 10 seconds for safety tip that I gave earlier. When you start thinking that way, when you start thinking about, you know, how to be prepared, not scared, using that mentality, this stuff comes to you. You're more aware of situations that, you know, that you wouldn't have been aware of before. Distraction techniques are less likely to catch you off guard. You're going to approach that situation with skepticism and excuse yourself from that situation as quickly as possible.
David, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here for your listeners. Thank you.
That's nationally acclaimed safety expert David Nance. Again, make sure to check him out on his website, personalsafetyexpert.com.
A big thank you going out to all of my guests this week, Chaos, Diane Keefe, John C. Frank, as well as David Nance. Here's your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Sydney J. Harris. The time to relax is when you don't have time for it. Don't forget to check us out on our social media, on Twitter, at Kay Alexander Show, as well as on Facebook, The Kelly Alexander Show, and our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. If you have any comments or questions, I always appreciate your emails, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I'll chat soon.